This is Radio Times. I'm Artie Moss-Cohen. By now, you know the Atticus Finch you met and loved in To Kill a Mockingbird is a bigot and white supremacist in Go Set a Watchman. That's because of all the publicity surrounding the publication of Watchmen, Harper Lee's first novel that was apparently discovered in a safety deposit box. The story is set in the 1950s in Macomb, Alabama, as the civil rights movement begins to change the Southern way of life. Scout is 26 years old, living in New York City, and coming home for her annual visit to see her father, who's now 72 years old. Here's Reese Witherspoon reading the first page of Go Set a Watchman.
Since Atlanta, she had looked out the dining car window with a delight almost physical. Over her breakfast coffee, she watched the last of Georgia's hills recede and the red earth appear. And with it, 10 roofed houses set in the middle of swept yards. And in the yards, the inevitable verbena grew, surrounded by whitewashed tires. She grinned when she saw her first TV antenna atop an unpainted Negro house. As they multiplied, her joy rose. Jean Louise Finch always made this journey by air, but she decided to go by train from New York to Macomb Junction on her fifth annual trip home. For one thing, she had the life scared out of her the last time she was on a plane. The pilot elected to fly through a tornado. For another thing, flying home meant her father rising at 3 a.m, driving 100 miles to meet her in Mobile, and doing a full day's work afterwards. He was 72 now, and this was no longer fair.
Today in Radio Times, the controversy around the publication of Harper Lee's Go Set a Watchman. We'll be talking about the story, the writing, the characters, and much more. We have two guests who have joined us. Let me introduce them to you. William Giraldi is a contributing editor at The New Republic, author of two novels, Busy Monsters and Hold the Dark. And William Giraldi, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Good morning. Thank you.
You're very welcome. And also with us is Claire Suddeth. She's a staff writer for Bloomberg Businessweek. In fact, wrote a story about Monroeville, Alabama. That's Harper Lee's hometown. And Claire Suddeth, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
William, let me begin with you. And as I was reading this morning, 1.1 million copies of this old new novel that have been bought in the last week or so. The reviews of this book have been rather mixed itself. Should it have published? Was it ready for publication from your perspective?
No, it was not. It was never meant for publication. And I should say that those who conspired to peddle those 1 million copies of this book to those Mockingbird devotees are without a molecule of shame. Not a molecule. So I don't believe that the book should have been published. It was never meant for it. And of course, Miss Lee was not able to review this manuscript before publication. Remember that she was a young woman in New York in the mid-1950s when she began writing this. And so this is the work of an aspiring writer. This is a work of a novice. Also keep in mind that this draft was not deemed good enough by J.P. Lippincott, her publisher, her great editor, Tay Hohoff. It was she, Tay Hohoff, who pushed Ms. Lee to create what we now know as Mockingbird.
Well, let me quote something that Harper Lee apparently said to HarperCollins, and this was published as HarperCollins sent out press material. She says, "My editor, who was taken by the flashbacks to Scout's childhood, persuaded me to write a novel from the point of view of the young Scout. I was a first-time writer, so I did as I was told. I didn't realize it had survived. This would, of course, be the manuscript. So I was surprised and delighted when my dear friend and lawyer, Tonya Carter, discovered it. After much thought and hesitation, I shared it with a handful of people I trust and was pleased to hear that they considered it worthy of publication. I am humbled and amazed that all this happened now, published after all these years." And William Giraldi, it sounds like she's saying that she agrees with the publication of this novel.
Well, remember that statement was given not directly by Harper Lee to HarperCollins, nor to the numerous media outlets that reported it during that initial sortie of coverage in February. Everything that's been said by Harper Lee has been said through her lawyer, through Ms. Carter. And those of us who love and know the work of Ms. Lee are very skeptical as to whether or not those words sound like her. I should say that they do not. Here we have a woman who organized her entire life to avoid the very freshet of publicity that the publication of this manuscript was going to cause. And so the Times reported early in July that this would constitute an abrupt turnaround for an author who vowed never to publish another book again. Well, abrupt turnaround is one way to put it, I suppose. It is highly out of character, and the whole thing right from the beginning did not smell right at all. So this is why you have the controversy, because the way that this was rolled out, it does not pass muster.
Well, to you, Claire, you wrote about this in Bloomberg Businessweek. You went to Monroeville, Alabama, to talk with some of the people that knew and know Harper Lee, also talked with her lawyer. What was your impression about the relationship between this lawyer and Harper Lee?
Well, you know, that is a good question. I think, you know, you can't get to Harper Lee except through Tanya Carter. And for the most part, you can't get to her at all. Tanya Carter sort of approves who comes in and out of the nursing home where Harper Lee lives. Part of that, I think, you know, there is a little bit of necessity to that because over the years, people have traveled to Monroeville and tried to meet with Ms. Lee, who has, you know, famously refused interviews. And, mm-hmm. and there are stories of journalists sort of trying to break into her room at the nursing home. But even so, there are a lot of her friends who live in Monroeville who used to visit her for years and years and have suddenly been cut off from her. And, you know, HarperCollins did meet with her. They did talk to her. They presented her with a copy of Watchmen right before it was published. And they also met with her in February after the news of Ghost Head of Watchmen was already announced, I believe. So, you know, she is aware of this book, but everything has gone through Tanya Carter. She, you know, she discovered it. She brought it to Ms. Lee, who was, you know, quote unquote, surprised by the fact that it was still around, and then sort of sent it to her publisher, sent it to her editor, you know, sort of put the wheels in motion, I should say.
And we should add that Tanya Carter was a law partner of Harper Lee's sister, yes?
Yeah. So Alice Lee was 15 years older than Harper Lee, and she actually died only last year at age 103.
Yes.
And she was a practicing lawyer in Monroeville and had been since the 1940s. She worked at her father's law firm. And then Tanya Carter started, I think, in the 80s as a secretary. And Alice and Harper Lee had a tendency to try to mentor young women. There's another secretary that I was told they had put through college. So they suggested that Tanya Carter go to college. She went to law school at Alice Lee's suggestion. And then when she graduated in 2006, she became a partner at the law firm.
Well, and I guess the question is, and as you wrote, Claire, this is a woman that has the power of attorney. She's managing the Lee estate, apparently runs a nonprofit that was started recently. So the question is she protecting Harper Lee, or is she taking advantage of Harper Lee? And I don't know from your reporting and interviewing whether you can answer that question.
Well, I think that, you know, the facts are all circumstantial, but when you piece them together, they sort of speak for themselves. You know, she took over. So Alice Lee used to run Harper Lee's affairs. And then in 2011, she had some health problems and went into a nursing home herself. And so Tanya took over. And from that time on, Harper Lee has been sort of taking a more active or litigious interest, I suppose you could say, in To Kill a Mockingbird's legacy. She sued her former literary agent because he had essentially gotten her to sign away the rights to To Kill a Mockingbird to a company that he ran. So she sued him and got them back. Then she sued the Monroe County Heritage Museum, which runs a sort of To Kill a Mockingbird type museum in the old courthouse in town and sells Mockingbird themed knickknacks. And so she sued them for copy or trademark infringement. She applied for a trademark for To Kill a Mockingbird, you know, and now she is publishing this new book. And it's only after Tonya Carter took over did all of this stuff happen, when for years and years and years, you know, Harper Lee had essentially receded from the public eye, had insisted she would never publish again, and seemed to take a pretty, you know, sort of... she didn't feel that great about the museum, I suppose, for years because she didn't like people capitalizing on To Kill a Mockingbird. But she knew about it and didn't really seem to mind it. So it just raises a lot of questions about, you know, why, as an 89-year-old woman in a nursing home, is she supposedly doing all this now? And why is it after, you know, Tonya Carter became involved in her life?
William, one of the critiques or criticisms I ran across was this charge of elder abuse. So we're talking about Harper Lee wrote this book something like 55 years ago, I guess, could have had it published decades ago and either didn't or wouldn't. Can we go so far as to call this elder abuse?
Well, you'd be onto something, I think. The Monroe officials who are in charge of investigating such things, or I should say the Alabama officials who are in charge of investigating such things, deemed her worthy of making her own publishing decisions. That verdict was given by functionaries, government functionaries, and you could be your own judge of how much you'd like to believe government functionaries. I'm not sure they're qualified to give that verdict, whether or not an author is fully cognizant of what's going on regarding the publication of her book. I have to apologize to Claire. I was cut off and I didn't hear everything that she said. And so you'll forgive me if I repeat anything. But you said, Marty, that she could have had this book published any time.
Mm-hmm.
That's exactly right.
Mm-hmm.
Novelists do not forget the larval versions of their books. They simply do not. And the reason is because they're often bad enough to brand themselves onto the memory, I'll have to say. But Harper Lee had decades of good health and sound judgment to publish this manuscript if she had wanted to, and she did not. And if she had thought the book was lost, all she had to do was look. She chose not to. That says something pretty powerful, I think. And
William Girardi, I'm not cutting you off. It's only
please.
Because we have to take a very short break, but we will pick up on that after this very short break. We're talking about Harper Lee, Go Set a Watchman, To Kill a Mockingbird, the controversy surrounding all of this. And do stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen. A quick recap here. Harper Lee's Go Set a Watchman, published last week, has received mixed reviews. It's a subject of controversy, which we are talking about, but no doubt will be the blockbuster of the summer. Our guests are William Giraldi. He's a contributing editor at The New Republic. He's been writing about Go Set a Watchman. Also with us is Claire Sedef, and she's staff writer for Bloomberg Businessweek, wrote a story about Monroeville, Alabama. That's Harper Lee's hometown. To join the conversation, what you make of this book, if you read it or not, maybe you don't want to read it, certainly give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. I see some Facebook comments here. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. William, you were talking about the fact that I guess Harper Lee had 55 or 50 years in which to decide whether to publish this or not, raising suspicions about this whole publicity campaign behind this novel?
Well, let's look at the timeline, Marty. On July 2nd, the New York Times reported that the original story sold to us by Ms. Carter, which was that she had just recently, just a few months before, discovered this manuscript. That the official line was challenged by this July 2nd Times report. In fact, the manuscript was discovered in October of 2011, and it was discovered when a rare books expert named Justin Caldwell, who was from Sotheby's, when he went to Alabama to meet with the lawyer, Tanya Carter, and also Harper Lee's agent at that time, whose name was Samuel Pincus. And it was then, in the bank vault, that everyone discovered Gossetta Watchman, or let's say saw it, found it, in October of 2011, not, as Ms. Carter had told HarperCollins and the world, just a few months before. Now, what was the case in 2015 that was not the case in 2011? If indeed everyone had discovered that book in the bank vault in October of 2011, what was different from then to now? The answer is that Alice Lee was still alive in 2011, and in 2015 she is not. Alice Lee, as Claire was saying earlier, it was by all accounts the steadfast bodyguard of her sister's interests. And there, the Times earlier in February, during the initial blitzkrieg of publicity, had quoted from a letter that Alice Lee had wrote to another author, someone named Marja Mills, who is also the author of a book about the Lees. And in that letter, Alice Lee says that her sister can't see and can't hear and will sign anything put before her by anyone in whom she has confidence, anyone she perceives as a friend. Now, this is from her own sister in 2011, saying that Harper Lee can't see or hear. So you see why the speculation has arisen.
Questions of time and clear. Anything you want to add to that? And there is, it's a bit complicated, but there is, I guess there are several versions of the discovery of this manuscript.
Yeah, so essentially, you know, William is right in everything that he has said. The one thing that I would add is that, so Tanya Carter initially said that she, you know, discovered this and had no idea it existed. And then it came out that actually in 2011, Sotheby's had sent its rare books expert down there and had met with her and Samuel Pincus, and that was a meeting specifically to appraise Harper Lee's belongings for her estate. There's also her original typewriter that she wrote To Kill a Mockingbird on is in there, and they had her authenticate it, writing something out saying, you know, this is the typewriter that I wrote my novel on. So stuff like that. And so they looked at Watchmen, according to Samuel Pincus, and it definitely knew that this second manuscript existed. When I talked to him, he was very hesitant to refer to it as a novel because, you know, it's really just a draft. So once that came out, you know, Tanya Carter still sticks by her statement saying that she discovered it in August last year, 3 months after Alice's death. She does say that, you know, she did meet with Sotheby's rare books expert, but she claims she was out of the room at the time. You know, she didn't know what they were talking about, all this sort of stuff. And then after sort of being pressed on this and you know, more details have come out with Pincus, and Sotheby's hasn't officially commented, but it seems likely that they have at least confirmed accounts. They had confirmed to me that, you know, what had been printed was correct and that Carter was in the room with the men when they discussed the manuscript. She has said, well, actually, she discovered the book in August because she remembered that she had seen something at an earlier time, and she decided to check to see if maybe there was a second book. So she was looking for a second book when she discovered Gossetta Watchman, which, as anyone who has ever, you know, happened upon something so surprising, you're usually not looking for it if it really truly is lost.
I mean, how big is this safety deposit box that, you know, you can be rooting around it and not find a manuscript written by Harper Lee?
Yeah, well, it was apparently in a box bound, you know, with the returned manuscript from To Kill a Mockingbird. So, you know, at her Lee's current literary agent, Andrew Nirenberg, has has also visited the safety deposit box, actually, with Carter several years before, and he says he held the manuscript, but he didn't realize what it was because it was under To Kill a Mockingbird. But, you know, that means that you place a number of people in the safety deposit box, you know, looking at this at some point. You know, people seem to have known at least there was this other draft. It just raises a lot of questions about, you know, whether or not it was actually such a surprise in August.
Well, I do want to talk about the novel itself. And William Giraldi, we played a little clip of a reading by Reese Witherspoon, the very first page of To Set a Watchman. Mm. And I just to share my personal experience, I found the first number of pages rather engrossing, and I thought some of the descriptions of her going south and going back to this town and what it looked like and even sort of meeting some of the people there for the first time, I was intrigued until what seemed like these arguments that she would get in with her father and with other members of her family about race, and those felt like talking points, felt very staged to me. Are there flashes of Harper Lee's, I guess, To Kill a Mockingbird, her gifts as a writer? Do you find any of them in Go Set a Watchman?
No, I don't.
You don't?
I find two clauses that were saved, that were smuggled in from Watchmen to Mockingbird. There are only two that I noticed. I'm speaking about word for word contraband from Mockingbird, from Watchmen to Mockingbird, and one of them is quite good. The words are her aunt Alexandra's corset drew up her bosom to giddy heights, and that's quite nice.
Yeah.
The other one is a train wreck clause that shouldn't have been smuggled in. But I wish I could agree with you that there are that those opening pages are engrossing. They aren't to my eye. And if you're asking, is the author of Mockingbird visible in Watchmen? I do not think she is. And the 2.5 years that it took to transform Watchmen into Mockingbird, those are instrumental years for a writer. You've got to remember that Harper Lee was a young woman in New York in the mid-50s, and she was teaching herself how to write. And 2.5 years for an aspiring novelist who's teaching herself how to write, who's reading and who's writing a lot, those 2.5 years are profoundly instrumental. Mm. And so she was also helped along to a great deal by Tay Hohoff, by the editor of J.P. Lippincott, who was really responsible for nurturing her as a writer, not just Hohoff, but also Harper Lee's first agent, a man named Maurice Crane, who was responsible for selling this book to Hohoff at Lippincott. It's interesting that Crane's didn't like the title. Crane didn't like the title Go Set a Watchman at all. He said, it sounds like it has something to do with clocks or something, and I don't quite like that. He said, let's change the title to Atticus. And Harper Lee said, that's wonderful. Let's change the title to Atticus. Because the book is really, or at least what we know of, what we know now know as Mockingbird, is hymned in love to her father. Remember, Harper Lee's father was also an attorney, and he had also, in the early 1900s, defended unsuccessfully two black youths from the charge of murder. Those youths were hanged, and so this is Atticus was. It's actually quite a nice title. I'm not sure that the world would agree that To Kill a Mockingbird should have been called Atticus, but it gets at what Harper Lee's motive was with the transformation of Watchmen into what we now know as Mockingbird.
Well, as William was talking about, Claire, the editor, obviously not pleased with Go Set a Watchman, telling her essentially it was a series of anecdotes. I'm just curious, though, about your response to this first novel just published last week.
Well, you know, I think what William said is correct. I found the early parts of the book where, you know, Jean Louise, who is a scout, is 26 and returning back home and thinking about her town, quaint and charming, but I don't know if I would refer to it as, you know, a great work of literature. I think
I would agree with you on that. Okay, fair enough.
But, you know, I think where the book really struggles is, you know, so you have these sort of quaint, Lake Wobegon-esque, you know, depictions of a town. And then you're halfway through the book and you are hit smack in the face with, you know, Atticus's just absolutely, you know, racist diatribes, more or less. And I think you can see that Harper Lee was a, you know, a young novice writer coming from this small town and seeing the racial tension, racial inequality that she grew up with, and clearly wanted to write about that. And this is her first attempt, and it's not very good at accomplishing that, because there are huge sections of the book where, you know, Atticus lays out his point of view from a 72-year-old man and white man in the 1950s, and then Scout lays out her view as a young woman in the white woman in the 1950s who lives in New York. But even so, as a young woman in the 1950s, her view is still not really what we generally think today. And so you have this very dated argument about what is essentially going to be the civil rights movement, although they don't quite realize it yet in the book. And it, first of all, it's clunky. Second of all, it doesn't quite make sense. You know, I mean, there's a part where Atticus is talking about how, you know, you can't have, you know, Negroes, as he calls them, in your schools and in your workplaces and that sort of thing, because then everyone will want to marry them. And Scout says, well, I live in New York and I ride the buses with black people and I don't want to marry them. And I think that's not the right argument that we want in 2015. And, you know, this book is dated. It was written a long time ago. But then when you think about its legacy in terms of, you know, Harper Lee didn't even really want it published to begin with. And if it is somehow of some literary value to publish today, you know, we are reading something that's so far off from what we think today as a society, hopefully. Clearly, we're not through all of this. But still, it just doesn't work. And it's unfortunate.
Well, let me just jump in here and go back to you, William Giraldi. One of the things that I found, and I agree this is not a great work of literature by any stretch of the imagination, but it was interesting to read this in light of all the debate and controversy about the Confederate flag that we're having today. And I'm not saying that this is, you know, the great insight about racial politics in the country, but it was just an interesting, a bit jarring experience to knowing what's happening in our real world today and what's happening in this novel. Does that make sense to you at all?
That's right. It does. I mentioned this in the second installment for my series at the New Republic. HarperCollins couldn't have planned a better summer to release this book. Remember that Trayvon Martin is still fresh in our minds. Remember that that Michael Brown and Ferguson, the wounds of that disaster still separate. Remember that Chicago was a weekly hecatomb. Remember that it took the assassination of 9 peaceful human beings in a church in Charleston, South Carolina, in June, for that state's representatives to sprout a conscience and take down an omnibigoted and insurrectionist flag about 150 years too late, I should say. So the race arguments that you see in Watchmen, I agree with Claire that they are haltingly confected. They are the equivalent of pamphleteering. I'm also made distinctly uneasy by criticizing the young woman who wrote this draft. I've got to say again, I know I said it earlier, but we should not forget it. Harper Lee did not have the opportunity to check this manuscript before it went to print. She didn't have the opportunity to revise it. I'm not even certain that she was aware, is aware, of what's going on. And there's some evidence for that. Again, Alice Lee, who wrote another letter in 2010 to Margaret Mills, in which she says that her sister cannot remember one minute to the next. Harper Lee had a stroke in 2007. I don't know if that has been mentioned yet. As I said, I was off. I got disconnected earlier. But let's bear that in mind. Harper Lee had a stroke in 2007, and so her sister said that she cannot remember one thing to the next. That she's always surprised. Her sister says because it's as if she's hearing everything for the first time, even if she's just heard it. And so
let me just jump in here only because about a minute please. Before our break here. And to you, Claire, one of the critiques and reviews of the book that I read that I found interesting, I'm not sure I entirely agree with it, but wondering whether to Set a Watchman is a more honest book than To Kill a Mockingbird. And there's the liberal use of the word, the N-word, in this book as well. And it's obviously a much much harsher view of race relations.
I think, I think it's less refined, in terms of a work of art. But they really, Scout and her father really argue about some stuff that, people did grapple with that, and people held Atticus's views, unfortunately, back then, and some people still do today, probably.
Well, let's take that short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. That's Claire Suddeth. She's a staff writer for Bloomberg Businessweek. Also with us, William Giraldi, contributing editor at The New Republic. Written a couple of novels himself, one called Busy Monsters and Hold the Dark. And the novel that we are talking about in this hour of Radio Times is Harper Lee's Go Set a Watchman. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Have you read the book? Do you have an opinion about it? Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss Cohen, talking about the story behind the story, the Go Set a Watchman novel, published last week, written by Harper Lee, something like 55 years ago. I do want to play a scene from the movie To Kill a Mockingbird, starring Gregory Finch as Atticus Finch. And let's give it a listen. In this scene, he's talking with Scout after the trial.
I'm simply defending a Negro, Tom Robinson. Scout, there are some things that you're not old enough to understand just yet. There's been some high talk around town to the effect that I shouldn't do much about defending this man.
If you shouldn't be defending him, then why are you doing it?
For a number of reasons. The main one is that if I didn't, I couldn't hold my head up in town.
And again, Gregory Peck playing Atticus Finch. I wonder, William Giraldi, whether the movie has kind of colored our view, our perceptions of To Kill a Mockingbird.
It certainly has. I can't speak from personal experience because I never saw the film.
You never did?
I never did.
Why
and,
is that?
Well, for an interesting reason, I think I'm not a film guy. I'm not a big movie guy. And when I was given this assignment, I made sure not to watch the film. I write about books. I'm a literary essayist, not a movie critic. Yeah, and so it was important to me once I knew that I was going to go back to reread Mockingbird and read this new book and write about it. It was important that I not see the film, but Gregory Peck in the film from the brief clips that I've seen, he's divine, and I've got a lot of emails from people who this week and last week from people who seem to know only the movie. They right. make references to the book when they really mean the movie. That's a little bit of a problem, I think. Remember, the movie, from what I've read, does not take in all of the book, and it wouldn't be able to do that anyway. Most movies based on books can't. But I guess you love the film, Marty.
I did. I totally identified with Scout. I thought of my dad as Atticus Finch. Let me get Claire in, and then I do want to get some callers as well. Claire, do you think the movie is, I'm not saying overshadowed the novel, but has created a kind of perspective on this novel, To Kill a Mockingbird?
I think definitely. I mean, the fact that we're still talking about a movie that came out in 1962 and still talking about Gregory Peck as Atticus tells you just how sort of indelible his portrayal of this character is. And for a lot of people, I think when they picture Atticus, they picture Gregory Peck. You know, that happens a lot of times when you see a movie, even after you've read the book. You then start picturing Harry Potter as Daniel Radcliffe, that sort of thing. But, you know, people still talk about it. They love it. Monroeville, you know, you can talk to some elderly people who still live there who will tell you stories about meeting Gregory Peck and what that was like. And, you know, I have seen the film a long time ago and then more recently. And actually, you know, when I started working on this, I realized that I owned it and I had forgotten that I owned it.
Interesting. And on second viewing?
Sort of tells you, yes. And definitely a second reading of To Kill a Mockingbird. And I think, you know, something that is important to remember about To Kill a Mockingbird is it is in over 80% of schools in the U.S. And most people are reading this book as young children. It's often read somewhere between 7th and 9th grade, where you're old enough to read, you know, adult literature. Although I think today To Kill a Mockingbird might be classified as young adult. But, you know, you're old enough to read this sort of stuff, but you're still young enough to have a sort of idealized view of the world, which is what Scout has that's shattered in the book, and then what Atticus represents. And people love Atticus in this way that, you know, they want the world to be full of people like him. Even though he fails ultimately in To Kill a Mockingbird, you know, he tries to defend Tom Robinson and Tom is found guilty anyway. But he's doing what's right, solely because it's right, even though he knows he's not going to succeed. And that sticks with people. I think, you know, much in the same way as a number of other books or works of art that you experience as a young person tend to stay with you longer than stuff you read or listen to later in life.
Let me read a bunch of comments from our Facebook page. Caitlin says, I have not purchased it as I'm feeling conflicted about how it came to be published. A Facebook comment from Teresa halfway through. So far, I like it. It reminds me of the style of Mockingbird, since there is a long build up to the heart of the story, which at this point seems to be Scout's coming to terms with her father's humanity. A Facebook comment from Jean. No, don't read this. It's a money grab. Elder abuse at the same time. Facebook comment from Kathy. I don't want to destroy my hero worship of Atticus Finch. Facebook comment from Carol. Read this book cover to cover. Read this book cover to cover yesterday. Yes, in one day. I loved it and found it to be so timely given the recent racially charged events throughout the South. A tweet from Joe. Totally agree with Marty. There are flashes of Lee in here. Overall disappointing. Facebook comment from Andrew. Hopefully the controversy and lack of story and editing sink this novel. I prefer Atticus to remain a noble character. My son was born 2 months ago. We decided on naming him after Atticus Finch. That name was such a safe choice for the last 50 years. And now this. So what we see, William, is just a diversity of comments about this novel and also about the original novel, if I can put it that way, To Kill a Mockingbird, and what to do with this character, Atticus Finch.
Mm. Well, I've got to say that those who are naming their children after Atticus aren't reading To Kill a Mockingbird very carefully, and I'll tell you what I mean by that.
Sure.
Atticus Finch is not the moral exemplar that readers have taken him to be, and I can't say whether or not this has been polluted by the film, by watchers of the film, by lovers of the film. I could speak only about the Atticus Finch portrayed in the novel. And I can tell you that there's something of a fatal flaw in his character, and that fatal flaw is this. He's assigned this case by Judge Taylor. He does not ask for it. And so there's a big distinction between insisting on this case because you know you're the right man for the job and because you want to defend this man's innocence because it's right, and just doing your job, just doing your duty. Now, he does his duty very well, but he doesn't choose to do it. It's given to him, right? That is something that should be something that should be remembered. As well, he is a bit passive. I say that in the final, I say in my piece that in the final analysis, he's perfectly passive, by which I mean he seems to accept the social upheavals that are happening around him, and of which he is now a part. He seems to be accepting all of this with the utmost composure. I mean, where are the spiritual upheavals of this character? Why is he not jarred? Why is he not jolted? Why is his very fabric not torn, shredded by what's happening to Tom Robinson and Atticus, is his own role in it? You never see that. You see a man who's acquiesced to the social upheavals. He does his best. His best isn't good enough, and he just moves along. He moves on. That needs to be looked at more closely.
Well, and I do want to get to some callers. Claire, in the Go Set a Watchman, when Scout, as I'll call her, is arguing with her father, Atticus, she says to him, in a sense, what you really believe in is the law, but you do not believe in civil rights. And I don't know if that was, you know, some revelation that she had, but I thought in discussing this, it's an interesting analysis of her own father.
Yeah, and I think that sort of points to, you know, the Atticus that's in To Kill a Mockingbird. I sort of think of them as two different characters for several reasons. They just don't sound the same. They don't represent the same things. But, yeah, essentially, you know, this is a man who believes in the law and is a lawyer and will, you know, follow it, you know, to the letter. But when faced with the question of, you know, does he want to live in a world in which, you know, black people are equal to him and are allowed in the same stores and going to his children's schools, he doesn't want that.
Right.
And Scout doesn't understand that, and she can't figure out why you would feel that a man, you know, was worthy of justice in the legal system and then not justice in society.
Let me get Adam from Point Pleasant to join our conversation. Hi, Adam. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hey, guys. How you doing?
Good.
I just had a question for your guests. The Go Set a Watchman strikes me as, like, okay, it's supposed to be this draft of To Kill a Mockingbird. That's the impression I'm getting. Is there times when the author's intent is kind of outweighed, you know, the idea that, oh, she never wanted it published, is that outweighed by the need for a historical record of how people write? I'm thinking of, like, Nabokov's The Original Laura, which he originally wanted burned and then inevitably got published in sort of note card fashion, or like Salinger, who's sitting on, you know, there are all these manuscripts, and I, at least for me, I want them published one day. Where does that, you know, divide work for your guests?
Well, that's an interesting question. I'm going to put that to you, excuse me, William Giraldi, because you're a writer, and I guess it's, what does the writer want? What does the public want? Maybe what do literary historians want?
Yes. Well, we had our answer for decades. Did Harper Lee want this published? We have our answer. For decades, she chose not to do that. As I said earlier, if she thought the manuscript lost, all she had to do was look. Do we have a right to this? We feel that, don't we? As American consumers, we feel we have the right to this, to this work of art that was written by a writer we adore. It is our right. I'm sorry to say, but it is not. This author chose not to publish this as a book. We've got to have some amount of respect for that. Now, it's a different story, I think, if this would have remained, this manuscript would have remained with dignity, boxed in Harper Lee's archives, and it was made available to scholars who wanted to study her evolution. That's something else, and that's something that I could get behind. I'm sorry that I cannot get behind the sinister packaging of this manuscript as a book by HarperCollins to then be peddled to the millions and millions of Mockingbird devotees. There's something that's scandalous about that, is there not?
Well, I hear you, and certainly you've made that point very clear during the hour. Let me get Madeline from Wilmington, Delaware, to join us. Hi, Madeline. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Well, I'm bored, Madeline, but my parents and everyone I know has called me Scout, I can remember. But and I haven't read the new book, but we grew up, my mom used to read us chapters of the old one, and then as I grew up, I read it multiple times myself. And from my own experience dealing with my parents, as you get older, you see the different sides of them that you couldn't as a child, and could it just be that Scout is now just being the different, like, who her father is that her young, 5-year-old self couldn't?
Absolutely, Madeline. That was one of the thoughts that I had. Claire, do you want to weigh in on that as well?
Yeah. Well, one thing that struck me when I was reading Ghost at a Watchman is, the story is this woman realizing that her invaluable father actually is quite flawed. But what's interesting to me is if this had been published originally, To Kill a Mockingbird would have never been written, and we wouldn't have this idea of Atticus. And there isn't really a good explanation in Ghost at a Watchman about, why Atticus is supposed to be so adored. You have the child's adoration of her father, but you don't really get a sense in Ghost at a Watchman about why he's so wonderful. She just sort of says that he is. And in fact, Tom Robinson's trial is briefly mentioned, and actually the outcome is different. He was acquitted, and he was acquitted in a way that it would make readers today uncomfortable, where they realize that the age of consent in Alabama back then was 14, and so they decided that they could argue that Mayella Ewell, as I believe her name is, actually just consented to it, and it's not that he was actually innocent. So you just don't get the Atticus that you see in To Kill a Mockingbird, and it seems like everyone, myself included, reading this, can't help but compare, take what they know of these characters and put it in this book, when you realize that if you read it as a standalone book, that stuff isn't even in there.
Well, and we're almost out of time here, William Giraldi, but it's so interesting to me. I mean, we're talking about, and I think people are thinking about Atticus as if he's a real person. I mean, he's that real, I think, to so many people.
Well, you're right about that, Marty. I think good literature, the best literature, yeah, does that, doesn't it? It brings these people right off the page and right into our rooms and into our lives. They climb around into our imaginations and live there always, some of them. Atticus is one of those characters. He lets us feel good about ourselves. We feel quite nice that there are Atticuses out there in the world who are doing good when good needs to be done. It absolves us, I think, of our own capitulation, of our own indolence in the face of social injustice. We Americans, most of us, at any rate, would rather not be an Atticus. We'd rather go about our cozy consumer lives, and so it feels quite good. This book is a feel-good book in a way that Huckleberry Finn is not.
Well, my thanks to both of you, William Giraldi, Claire Sudeth, for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you.
We're going to close things out. The theme music from the 1962 film To Kill a Mockingbird, composed by Elmer Bernstein.